Hi, I'm Patty Daniels. I'm the supervising producer of The World. Often when you think of The World, you might first think about the voices and the reporting you hear on air. It's essential journalism that connects you and helps you understand the world around you. But there is so much more that is going on behind the scenes to make this show work. That means producers, editors, engineers, our whole studio team, all working together to bring you the best journalism with the highest production values. Our team has to be nimble, responsive, and rely on deep experience to make sure the news program you hear each weekday afternoon is the best it can be. We do this work for you. And actually, we can't do this work without you. We have a fundraising goal now through December 31st to raise $67,000 to support our nonprofit newsroom. And we're counting on you to make this campaign a success. Trusted global journalism is already reason enough to give. But here's one more incentive. A generous donor will match your donation one for one. Consider making a gift of $250 to The World. And our newsroom will receive $500 thanks to you and the power of teamwork. Visit theworld.org/give to learn more and make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you. Your gift makes all the difference. And now, here's the show.
Israel shells Gaza, Hamas shells Israel. Many Israelis who are looking for a safer situation have fled their country. More than 5,000 have arrived on the small island nation of Cyprus.
Absolutely, everyone was joining to help and even to accommodate the people in their homes. So it was a big welcoming.
Also today, China, you suggest make a lot of tech for the West. Practice makes perfect, and now China is rivaling the U.S. and Europe as an innovator.
It's continuing to make things. And I think that's really the essence of its advantage.
And we look at loneliness. Globally, it's being treated as a public health crisis because it increases your risk of an early death.
But when we're more socially connected, it actually increases survival by 50%.
The hard work of fighting isolation and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Thanks, as always, for joining us. Despite the risks of being exposed in a combat zone, the pace of Palestinians fleeing northern Gaza is picking up. They're heading to the southern part of the territory on foot and with donkey carts, while the Israeli ground and air offensive in Gaza continues. More than 10,500 Palestinians have been killed there since the war started. That's according to the Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza. Meanwhile, Israel continues to be targeted by rocket fire flying in from Gaza and Lebanon. In the past month, thousands of Israelis have left their country seeking safety elsewhere. As the world's Duri Biskaran reports, the nearby island nation of Cyprus has seen a large number of new arrivals.
Menachem, a father of two, says he was sheltering with his family in their apartment building in the Israeli city of Ashdod when it was hit by a rocket.
I go out to the balcony and I see that there's just black smoke all over.
It was the third day of the war. No one was killed when his building was hit, but Menachem says five of his neighbors were injured in the blast. He and his wife decided it was time to get out. He's asked us not to share his full name due to fears of anti-Semitic attacks outside of Israel.
You know, at that time, the tickets were getting sold out like crazy. People were just running to the airport and buying whatever was there. And so my friend was able to find tickets to Cyprus, and I'm very, very happy and grateful for him that he chose Cyprus.
Cyprus, a Mediterranean island nation not far off the coast of Israel, served as a transit hub as evacuation ships brought foreign citizens out in early October. But some didn't just pass through. They chose to stay.
Absolutely. Everyone was joining to help and even to accommodate people in their homes. So it was a big welcoming.
Rabbi Ari Ziv Raskin, who leads the island's central synagogue, says 5,000 families from Israel have taken shelter here in the past month. That's on an island with just over 1 million people.
But you know, after a week or so, it's becoming a bit heavy for people to have a guest. And we had to find different solutions to hire for them an apartment.
Raskin says Jewish community leaders use WhatsApp groups to coordinate housing, food, and medical care. His synagogue hired 24-hour security and erected protective barriers to give new arrivals a sense of security.
We have many mothers with their children here alone. The father had to join the army to protect the nation of Israel. As well, we have many single mothers, nobody to count on to feel safe.
In the past years, Cyprus has become home for many people fleeing war. In August, the island received the most asylum applications per capita in all of Europe, according to the EU. There are communities of Russians, Ukrainians, Syrians, and Palestinians. Many Palestinians in Cyprus have family members in Gaza who have been unable to escape from the blockaded strip. Only a few hundred people have been permitted to leave through Egypt in recent days. In recent weeks, Cypriots have organized several demonstrations in solidarity with Palestinians.
I mean, there's a lot of unease in the air here in Cyprus, and the only thing that people seem to talk about is Gaza and how much longer and how many more people will have to be massacred for all of this to stop.
Sareen Sadek is a Palestinian chef who's lived in Cyprus for several years.
When you ask me how I have been feeling the past few weeks, I can't say it's necessarily strange, but rather something that had been hidden in your subconscious, like some sort of generational trauma that gets triggered every time Israel commits another atrocity.
Sadek was appalled by Cyprus's decision to abstain from a UN vote calling for a ceasefire, especially because the northern part of the island has been occupied by Turkey since 1974.
Cyprus itself, as an island, knows firsthand what it means to have their land taken from them and to be powerless and unheard in global politics. So to see their government blandly take the side of Israel, especially when there is also such a large Palestinian and Arab community on the island, has been truly a disappointment.
Menachem, the Israeli father whose apartment block was hit by a rocket, says political tensions haven't translated into arguments or issues with his new neighbors in Cyprus. He and his wife are staying in an Airbnb, working remotely, and taking the kids to the beach in their spare time. But he still doesn't feel safe wearing clothing that might identify him as Jewish.
For the first time in my life, I have been wearing a hat to cover my yarmulke, tucking in my tzitzit, which is the strings that you see from Orthodox Jews.
Menachem says he's supportive of Israel's continued bombardment of the Gaza Strip as it attempts to rout Hamas. He says civilian deaths of Palestinians are unfortunate, but he believes Israel is defending itself.
Overall, people in Israel, we want to have peace. We don't want to be living in these crazy wars. We don't want terrorist attacks. So we need to figure out a way that we can both live in this country because the both of us are not going anywhere.
He says he and his family hope to return to Israel as soon as they can. For The World, I'm Derry Buscarin.
With no heads up at all, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Iraq. He wore a flak jacket on the tarmac after landing in Baghdad, an indication of the danger U.S. installations have faced in Iraq recently. Militias in the country backed by Iran have lobbed explosive drones and rockets at U.S. bases. The Department of Defense says that U.S. personnel have been injured, though how many or how badly is not clear. This appears to be something of a simmering Eastern Front in the Mideast crisis. So Blinken flew in to try and do something about it. Jonathan Lord was an Iraq country director for the Defense Department. Jonathan, Blinken met with Iraq's Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani. What did the two talk about?
They discussed the current ongoings in Gaza, the U.S. intentions to keep this war centrally located in Gaza and not to see it expand into other fronts in the Middle East.
Yeah. The State Department readout for the meeting says Blinken made clear the U.S. would defend its interests and personnel. Is that a message that's more for the militias in Iraq than for Prime Minister Sudani?
Very much so. The militias in Iraq function with one foot inside the officially sanctioned popular mobilization forces and one foot outside. And it is under those auspices that these resistance groups are targeting the U.S. And he's made it very clear that at a time and place of their choosing, U.S. forces will defend themselves and respond to these attacks.
So is the concern at the State Department in Iraq, we're seeing an Eastern Front in the Mideast crisis? I mean, how would you say this is connected to the Israel-Hamas war?
The U.S., for its part, wants to keep that from spreading and escalating. So they're really walking a balance beam here of responding sufficiently to the attacks to demonstrate self-defense while not getting into a tit for tat that brings us higher up the escalation ladder and walks us into a conflict with these militias.
So what is Iraqi Prime Minister Sudani's relationship with the Iranian militias like? When Secretary Blinken walked in the room for that meeting with Sudani, I mean, what does he see?
The unfortunate truth is that the Iraqi Prime Minister, Sudani, or any really other before him, doesn't hold much sway over these groups. These groups get a lot of support and influence from Tehran, but even then, that influence can wax and wane. These groups really operate at this point sometimes in competition with each other to burnish their own credentials as the real Iraqis who are resisting the quote-unquote occupation of Iraq by U.S. forces.
So the visit by Blinken to Iraq seems significant, but what could the U.S. do to really show they're serious about deterring these militias?
Well, the U.S. has a tremendous amount of military capability in the region. Putting aside the two carrier strike groups and squadrons of fighter aircraft, the U.S. has also moved in additional air defense batteries. Ultimately, the president's walking a tightrope here where he wants to demonstrate to these groups that he means business and won't take these attacks lightly, but he doesn't want to get sucked into ultimately what they want, which is a broader conflict that then gives them reason to jump up and down and try to get the U.S. officially thrown out of Iraq. I would think that U.S. casualties would certainly precipitate a stronger response from Washington.
Is one of those options an airstrike inside Iraq?
Like many options in the Middle East, we run the menu from pretty bad options to fairly terrible options. And an airstrike in Iraq actually plays to the hand of the militias. And so I think Washington is very careful to target these groups outside of Iraq to not make the case that the U.S. is trampling or otherwise undermining Iraqi national sovereignty.
Jonathan Lord was a political military analyst at the Pentagon working on Iraq. Jonathan, thank you very much for your help in understanding all this.
Thanks so much, Marco.
In Colombia, a high-profile kidnapping, the father of Luis Diaz, a Colombian soccer star who plays for Liverpool in the UK, was abducted by a guerrilla group. 11 days have now passed with the drama complicating peace talks in Colombia. The Royal's TBC Isaiah reports.
When the parents of Colombian soccer player Luis Diaz were kidnapped last month in their hometown of Barrancas, authorities initially blamed members of organized crime. They launched a huge rescue mission involving hundreds of members of the police and the military, and they were able to rescue the mother, Celinis Marulanda, but not the father, Luis Manuel Diaz. A week later, the president of Colombia, Gustavo Petro, announced who the kidnappers were.
Que el ELN hoy es el responsable de la vida del papá de Luis Díaz.
The National Liberation Army, known as the ELN, was responsible, he said. And this complicated everything. First, because it was a reminder of a traumatic past that many Colombians want to forget, says Jorge Restrepo. He's the director of the Conflict Analysis Rescue Center in Bogotá.
Kidnapping was one of the most pervasive forms of violence that the guerrillas have accomplished in the past in Colombia. We have already managed to overcome that very serious form of violence.
The Colombian government and the ELN guerrilla group recently agreed to a ceasefire until January of 2024, something unprecedented.
The first 3 months of the ceasefire has been relatively peaceful in terms of actions, violent actions of that guerrilla.
And then this kidnapping happened. The head of the ELN said the motivation for the kidnapping was purely economic and that they didn't know that the victim was actually the father of the famous soccer player. But Luis Fernando Trejo, a political scientist at the University of the North in Colombia, says that's not credible.
No creo que haya habido un error. Teniendo en cuenta que un secuestro tiene una planificación.
He says it's unlikely that they took Diaz's father by mistake, given all the planning that's required for a kidnapping like this and how well known the victims are in their hometown. What the ELN didn't anticipate, Trejo says, is all the media attention. On Sunday night, the head of the rebel group said he ordered the liberation of Diaz's father. It's not clear why that hasn't happened. The ELN said they were seeking security guarantees from the police, but Jorge Restrepo says a possible reason is that their guerrilla group might not be united.
The ELN might be finding difficult to negotiate internally to give these forces something back.
What is clear, he says, is that this is having a negative impact on peace negotiations in Colombia.
The Colombian population distrusts strongly the ELN. They support the negotiation, but they think that the ELN was not going to honor their commitments as part of the negotiation.
He says this kidnapping might further erode trust in the peace process. On Sunday, Luis Diaz made an emotional plea during a soccer game in Luton in the UK.
Well, Luis Diaz, to rise like that and score like that with everything going on in his life.
After scoring a goal for Liverpool, he lifted his shirt to display the message, Freedom for Dad. For the World, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
Want to dive into how technology and Black spirituality intersect? Or confront the challenges new tech is creating? Maybe even catch a vision of hope for the future?
Check out Moral Repair, a Black exploration of tech. A podcast about the innovations that make our world and break our societies.
And how we can all heal just a bit. Available on Spotify, Apple, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Darren.
And I'm Esther.
And this is Second Sunday, a podcast about Black queer folk finding, keeping, and sometimes losing faith.
This season's full of candid conversations. We're talking to theologians, artists, activists, and community members living at the intersections of faith, spirituality, and identity.
The saints ain't ready for this.
But we're still going to talk about it.
Second Sunday. Find it wherever you get podcasts.
Second Sunday is a Cube original podcast and is part of the PRX Big Questions Project.
I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. It might sound counterintuitive in our hyper-connected world, but increasingly, loneliness is a concern. The U.S. Surgeon General has declared it a public health crisis. The U.K. and Japan both have a minister of loneliness. Global studies about loneliness show that it impacts people across class, culture, and ethnicity, whether you live in the city or the country. We got in touch with Julianne Holt-Lundstad. She's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University and the founder of the Global Initiative on Loneliness and Connection. The big question, Julianne, from a global perspective, are we more lonely now, or are we just talking about it more?
Well, it's a great question because certainly it has been brought to the forefront of our attention because we all experience significant isolation and loneliness associated with the global pandemic. But we do have data that has been tracking both loneliness specifically and other kinds of indicators of how socially connected people are. And while they do vary, there is some evidence to suggest that this has been increasing, and it was increasing prior to the pandemic.
So I mentioned that the U.S. Surgeon General declared loneliness a public health crisis. What are its physical health impacts?
We have very good evidence of the health impacts across multiple scientific disciplines and across decades. So for instance, in my own research, we gathered the available global data. And what we found was that not only is there an increased risk for earlier mortality by 26%, but when we're more socially connected, it actually increases survival by 50%. We also have very good evidence of its impact not only on our length of life, but our chronic kinds of conditions that would contribute to that. So for instance, it's been linked to risk for cardiovascular disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, and other kinds of chronic illnesses. But it's also been linked to more acute kinds of things like our immune functioning and how likely we are to develop a cold. It's also linked to cognitive health outcomes such as dementia and mental health outcomes, including depression, anxiety, and behavioral health, including things like addiction and suicidality. It's not surprising because humans are social beings and our neurobiology has adapted to expect social proximity. And so we have biological social needs. And when these aren't met, we can develop dysregulation in multiple biological systems that can lead to some of these outcomes.
If you look around the world, Julianne, are there any populations or groups that are less lonely for whatever reason, because of traditions maybe, or cross-generational living arrangements?
You know, it's really interesting because I think many people may view this as maybe something that's only relevant to wealthier kinds of nations. And some recent data from a Gallup Meta survey looking at the global state of connection, while they did find variation across the 142 countries that they surveyed, what's interesting is that it didn't seem to break down in a pattern that we might expect. We didn't see that, say, for instance, wealthier nations were lonelier than low and middle income countries. We also didn't find the similar kinds of patterns of what we might think of as more individualistic focused countries, the US, Canada, versus some of the countries in Asia, those that are more collectivistic. And so what it does suggest is, while there is some variation, this is a global issue, and it's something that is generalized across populations.
What about countries like the UK and Japan? I mentioned they have ministries of loneliness. What are they focused on? Like, what do they do to relieve loneliness?
So the UK, they were the first country to do this. And they have not only that leadership position, but they also have a national measurement so that they are able to track loneliness in their population. They also have a national strategy that has been widely scaled in terms of looking at like awareness campaign. Now, there was actually just a recent study looking at how effective the awareness campaign was, and albeit it was simply among older adults and simply in their mental health. But what this awareness campaign suggested is that it was helpful for older adults that were higher income, more educated, but that a longer time period may be needed to evaluate some of the longer term effects.
Julianne, are there certain countries around the globe that are doing things to combat loneliness that you find especially interesting?
Well, in South Korea, they announced, this was in the spring, that they are paying lonely young people $500 a month to reengage with society. This is a very kind of unusual type of approach. And so I'll be very interested to see how effective this is. And, you know, it's not something that I think many people might immediately jump to. And so I'm open and curious, but also somewhat skeptical.
You cited earlier several causes for this trend of loneliness. Just going back to the tech side of this briefly, I mean, we see a lot of people, old and young, almost self-isolating, wittingly or not. So if smartphones and electronics are people's new best friends, what can realistically be done to help us reduce our screen time and just reconnect with other people?
That's a great question, because one of the things that I have observed is that since the pandemic, and at a time where we needed to reduce our social contact, we've become quite comfortable spending more time alone, spending more time at home. And in fact, many people now prefer working remotely, and it may be more comfortable to get your entertainment at home, maybe order your groceries online. And it has now become quite comfortable to spend more and more time in isolation. And so it is concerning that we are more and more relying on this because of the kinds of conveniences and benefits that these, of course, provide.
How do you stay connected with people, Julianne?
I'm always working on this, right? I always having at the back of my mind, I shouldn't just be talking about this, researching it. I need to live it and practice it. And there are a few things that I do to help me make sure that I'm always making time for the people I care about. So I have regular get-togethers with friends. We get together at least once a month, and we have it on our calendars. I should mention the routines of some of these things are what can be really important, so that it's part of our daily, weekly, monthly routine. I have routines with my family, my extended family and routines with my friends and the small traditions that we always do some activity on a Friday, or we always celebrate birthdays in this way. And so as I set up these kinds of routines, it's not only something that I can plan on, but they can plan on as well.
Julianne Holt-Lonstadt is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University. She was also the lead scientific editor on the U.S. Surgeon General's advisory on loneliness. Julianne, thank you very much. This is a fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. It's wheels up for the pandas from D.C.'s National Zoo today. They're flying back to China. Pandas have been in Washington since the Nixon administration.
I think pandemonium is going to break out right here at the zoo.
Is today the end of an era?
Panda diplomacy has been positive, but panda diplomacy can become punitive panda diplomacy as well.
Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Russia's war in Ukraine has a potent cultural element to it, the destruction of places and artifacts that are significant to Ukrainian history. This fall, the team from the podcast Click Here reported in Ukraine on efforts to preserve important sites and monuments using 3D imaging. Here is Dina Temple-Raston from Click Here.
Tatiana Shershova has lived in Chernihiv, a city about 2 hours north of Kyiv, all of her life. And she recently walked me into the garden of a famous library there.
To me, it was never just a library. It was a place where everyone in Chernihiv gathered. We could meet writers, find people who shared our interests, and there were so many books.
The library wasn't always a library. At one point, it was an orphanage, and at the turn of the 20th century, it was owned by a rich collector. He eventually left it to the city with stacks of manuscripts and art inside, which the city then turned into a museum entirely devoted to Ukrainian culture. More recently, it became a kind of community gathering place. People would meet for tea in the garden in the back. There'd be book readings, Christmas concerts, like this one in 2018. Tatiana was totally unprepared for what would happen in March 2022, when the Russians decided to attack Chernihiv. She and her brother were at home when Russian planes began screaming across the night sky, dropping bombs on the city.
When the bombing started, I did what you are supposed to do. I fell to the floor and covered my head with my hands. My brother, he ran to the window. He's the kind of person who runs to the window. And my brother kept saying to me, get up, look outside.
And when she finally got up to look, she put her hand to her mouth in horror.
I could see the orange of fires against the dark sky.
It looked like the Russians had bombed her beloved library, potentially destroying hundreds of cultural artifacts that bore witness not just to Ukrainian history, but its identity too. As Tatiana watched her library go up in flames, she couldn't have possibly imagined the technology that would help her save it. For the people of Chernihiv, the bombing of the library left them stunned. It had survived the Bolsheviks in 1918, Nazi bombings in the 1940s, and now it seemed to have finally succumbed. When Tatiana looked back at the collapsed building, it looked like an old face, missing teeth. Serhiy Remvenko drove into Chernihiv a few days after the bombing to deliver some boxes of food for the survivors. And he said what he saw when he arrived looked like something out of a black and white movie from another era.
People that standing in a line waiting for your food in Chernihiv, that was really giving me the sense of the anger and the upsetting me.
He heard about the bombing of the youth library. It was all over the news. And since it wasn't far, he walked over to get a closer look.
I was really shocked by the damage, yeah, and how big the crater is.
He saw that the library hadn't suffered a direct hit. Planes had dropped a bomb, but it had missed the building by just a few feet. Serhii could see a gaping crater the size of a school bus where the library's garden had once been, and the building looked like it was going to slip down into it. Serhii pulled out his camera.
Actually, I have it right here.
Okay.
It's not that special. It's the
It's a good old Nikon.
It's a good old Nikon, right?
This wasn't the instinct of a random passerby taking a picture of a terrible tragedy. This is actually what Serhii does.
I'm a graduate architect, volunteer, and a 3D scanning specialist, and a surveyor.
He picked up that Nikon and snapped a photo. And then a few more. And more.
So I took around 1,000 at the time.
1,000 photographs from every conceivable angle, which might sound like a lot of pictures, unless you're an expert at something called photogrammetry, like Serhii. Photogrammetry literally means the act of deriving precise measurements from photographs, and it involves taking a set of overlapping photos of an object, or a building, or a person, and then converting them into something three-dimensional by using computer algorithms. But Serhii went a step further. He got together with some other architects and laid his hands on a laser scanner. Looks like a little miniature R2-D2 robot.
So basically, the laser scan gives you the millions of points, but it's precise in their coordinates.
The process is pretty simple. You point your R2-D2 at your object, the laser sends out a beam, and the beam bounces back, giving the precise shape of the object.
As we can see right now in this room, the plaster on the ceiling. But we don't know. Probably it was at some of the time repaired or just minor cracks was place the other plaster on top of that. Right. With the laser scan, I can see all of these.
So you could see plaster on top of concrete, for example, because of the intensity of coming
yes,
back.
Yes, and it's really revealing some of the things that you cannot capture with the human eye.
And he said, think about how long this used to take when you had just a tape measure and a friend.
Imagine how much time it took you to measure all of these points. Probably a couple of months, right? But this what you can get through the couple of hours with the laser.
When we started to calculate the budget, it became obvious that his 3D scanning and the model that was built based on the clouds of dots reduces the budget up to 20%.
That's Katerina Honcharova, a Ukraine heritage crisis specialist with the World Monuments Fund. She's working on the library restoration project.
You do not need to conduct architectural survey. All measurements are there. And, you know, take it by hands, all the architectural details, decorations. This all requires a lot of labor. So we had a perfect plan of the building. We had facades. It all was in his model.
Wow.
So this is why I'm all into 3D scanning, not only as an instrument to document the damage, but also as a very very serious investment in during the war and post-war recovery.
According to the Smithsonian Institution, there are about 30,000 cultural sites in Ukraine that have been deemed preservation worthy. 30,000. And while Ukrainians may not be able to physically protect all 30,000 of them, there is something they can do. Capture them in 3D. So some developers over at an innovation lab linked to the People at Vice Media created an app with UNESCO, the United Nations Cultural Organization. And their idea was to allow people to do a kind of point-and-click photogrammetry with their smartphones. And they called it Backup Ukraine. With traditional photogrammetry, you essentially have to take hundreds and hundreds of panoramic photos and then stitch them together with a sophisticated computer program. But with Backup Ukraine, all you have to do is open the app and methodically move your smartphone camera over whatever it is you want to preserve. Then it uploads that digital model to a secure server. It just takes a few minutes. We wanted to see how it works.
I'm Yuri.
So, Yuri, I'm Dina.
Nice to meet you, Dina.
Nice to meet you.
Yuri Artuk is one of the thousands of people who started using the app to memorialize statues and historic sites. And we met up with him in Kyiv, so he could show us the app in action.
It's all the latest, the iPhones and the other phones as well. I think they have a LiDAR scanner.
LiDAR scanner. That's the little R2-D2 camera we talked about before. But now there's a version of it in your smartphone.
And once I push this button, like the record button, we're going to actually begin scanning. And it's...
As he waves his phone back and forth, the image of the monument starts to emerge from the blue.
And we could see how it covers, like the blue area is the one that is not scanned yet. And then eventually, if I'm moving really slowly, we're going to get it. And then I should walk around it.
And you're trying to make the blue go away? Is that the idea?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Once he's walked slowly all the way around it, the 3D image on his screen looks like an exact replica of the monument. If you go to the Backup Ukraine website right now, you'll see statues and buildings that have already been scanned. The hope is, if these objects are destroyed in the war, these scans can be used to help rebuild them.
So normally we say that with the app, you can scan stuff that's bigger than a mouse and smaller than an elephant.
This is Tao Thompson. He's creative director of the Vice Innovation Lab behind the Backup Ukraine app. He lives in Denmark.
And if you need to go larger or smaller than that, then you need specialist equipment and you need specialist training. But within that scale, I would say that it's 90% as good as the professional results.
And very quickly, people were picking up their cell phones to help. Instead of bubble wrap, people were using their smartphones, downloading the app and scanning monuments and statues. And then this other completely unexpected thing happened. People started scanning random personal items. It started with, of all things, cupcakes. Lots of scans and uploads of cupcakes.
We were baffled, called immediately somebody saying, "What's up with the cupcakes?" And what we don't realize is that they're on the Orthodox calendar instead of the Roman calendar, I guess. So Easter is falls differently down there. And it was Easter to Orthodox Christian Ukrainians. It's the main family gathering of the year.
And a key part of the celebration includes, you guessed it, cupcakes. Tao said it reminded him of how personal and intimate culture can be. Because, of course, it's not just the things of national importance that are being destroyed in this war, but very personal things, too. And technology is being used to preserve them both. Funny thing about the Backup Ukraine app, within weeks of its launch, all the major cultural sites in Kyiv had been scanned and uploaded to the cloud. Tao Thompson said it was another quiet win for Ukraine.
How can you preserve a culture against such a formidable foe, make a backup and put it in the cloud? It can't get lost, it can't get flooded, and also it can't get bombed.
No matter how hard the Russians try. For The World, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina is the host of the Click Here podcast about the world of cybersecurity and intelligence. The story was produced by Sean Powers. China has transformed from a manufacturing hub for Western technology into a tech innovator in its own right, rivaling the U.S. and Europe. The PBS science series Nova takes a deep look at what's going on in a special airing tonight.
Is China becoming the world leader in technology?
The United States and China are locked in a big power struggle. Innovation creates global power.
Today, a tech war between China and the West is starting to heat up.
Kaiser Guo is a correspondent and narrator for the Nova film, Inside China's Tech Boom. Kaiser, why is China doing so well? What is its tech sector so good at?
I think it's good at a couple of things, Marco. I think scaling is one of them, and it's really important that we recognize that. The other thing is it's continuing to make things, and that's really the central point that we try to make in the film, that it has retained that process knowledge. And I think that's really the essence of its advantage, is that, you know, in the United States, we've hollowed out a lot of manufacturing, and I think we've come to regret that. And China, continuing to make things, sitting on top of the entire hardware supply chain, it's just been a really huge advantage for China.
Yeah, so you tipped into it there, the hardware supply chain. When you say China makes things, what kinds of things has pumped up China's tech muscle?
Everyone is familiar with these gigantic contract manufacturing companies like Foxconn, which is Taiwanese-owned but has most of its operations in China. And they make your MacBook Pro and your iPhone and your iPad and so many other advanced consumer technology devices. You know, you see that it says designed in California, made in China.
Right.
I think we shouldn't underestimate how enormous these operations are. They employ literally millions.
So listeners will be very familiar with one company in particular, Huawei. Here's one of your sources in the film, a cybersecurity expert named James Mulvenon.
Huawei is a genuinely impressive, state-of-the-art, world-class telecoms equipment manufacturing company. And it was their successes, particularly in 5G technology, that are really leading the way and are causing us to have to play catch-up to them.
Kaiser, what kind of catching up is he talking about there?
Right now, I mean, you look at a technology like 5G, which is going to be so fundamental to all future innovation, and China has the overwhelming majority of the fundamental patents underneath so much of the technology of 5G. China right now has something on order, you know, more than 2 million base stations already deployed across the country in 5G, and that just dwarfs what we've got in the U.S.
There's another tech expert you spoke with, Dan Huang. He says it's not just eureka moments in technology that are helping China to get ahead.
There is a more important part of technology, which is something I call process knowledge, which is simply the experience, the tacit knowledge, the understanding of how to make something. And so in the kitchen context, if you put someone into a super fancy kitchen decked out with really fancy gadgets, as well as extremely clear recipes, I think that person would have a hard time doing something as simple as frying an egg if he hasn't had some cooking experience in the past.
Is Dan Huang saying that outsourcing tech production to China has put the U.S. at a disadvantage?
Yeah, in a nutshell, he is. And the film, you know, you could actually see is sort of an argument for things like the Chips and Science Act and for the Inflation Reduction Act, for, you know, making things again in America. It's something the Germans never really stopped doing, and China certainly never intends to stop doing.
Is there a scenario here where the U.S. does not catch up to China?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, I think that's part of the reason we made the film. I think that it's hopefully going to ring some alarms.
I don't want to be naive, Kaiser, but can you imagine a world in which Chinese and U.S. tech are actually working together in ways that are useful for the whole planet and it's win-win?
I don't need to imagine too hard. I think that we need only go back 20 years, you know, with the birth of the Chinese internet. You look at the major Chinese tech players back then, they were founded mostly by returnees from the United States who'd studied in American universities. They were funded by Silicon Valley or Sand Hill Road venture money, and they went to capital markets in the United States. And everybody benefited. You know, the information horizons for Chinese people were broadened. Americans made a lot of money. We saw governance standards improve wildly for these Chinese companies that wanted to list on U.S. exchanges. And we saw a huge flow of technology talent from China to the United States, which is something we're in danger of losing now as we embrace kind of xenophobic attitudes, especially toward China.
Yeah, but while this macro tension rules the U.S.-China relationship, I imagine it'll be hard to get to that.
That's right, Marco. That's such a terrible pity.
Kaiser Guo is the correspondent for Inside China's Tech Boom, airing tonight on Nova. He's also the host of the Seneca podcast. Kaiser, thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thanks so much, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. A closely watched shuttle to the airport this morning in Washington, D.C. for three giant pandas who were given a warm but sad send-off at the National Zoo. This is Brandy Smith, director of the zoo's Conservation Biology Institute.
Everyone keeps asking me how I feel, and this is a hard morning. It's been a hard week, and it's been a hard morning.
After the ceremony, with officials from China, a motorcade escorted the pandas in three specially outfitted FedEx trucks, complete with pandas painted on the sides, to the airport to catch a 19-hour flight to Chengdu, China. In the years when the pandas were in Washington, they drew oohs and ahs from thousands of animal-loving visitors, making them among China's most effective diplomats. As WAMU's Jacob Fenston reports, it's still unclear whether today marks the end of the National Zoo's panda program or just a new chapter.
President Richard Nixon visited Communist China in February 1972, a historic thaw in the middle of the Cold War. 2 months later, Beijing sent a gift back to Washington.
A pair of giant pandas,
to the American people, in token of friendship of the Chinese people.
On a chilly April morning at the National Zoo, a delegation from China presented the bears to First Lady Pat Nixon.
On behalf of the people of the United States.
The pandas, she said, would be enjoyed by millions of Americans. There'd been no pandas at all in the U.S. for decades.
I think pandemonium is going to break out right here at the zoo.
Pandemonium did break out, and it's lasted more than five decades.
See Pandy right there?
I do see him right there. He's so cute, right?
Yeah.
4-year-old Madeline loves pandas. She was at the National Zoo for her birthday wearing a panda costume a few days before the animal's departure. Her mom, Christine Murray, says they came down from Pennsylvania to say goodbye. And it's not just kids. Alan Richter watched as one panda climbed a tree, then slid back down.
They're just so pure, and they're like gentle, and they're beautiful, and they're just like hanging out. I took the day off just to see them before they left because I thought, you know, I may never get to see pandas again in my lifetime.
Pandas only exist in the wild in China, so the country has a monopoly on one of the world's cutest animals. Since 1972, China's gifted or loaned pandas to countries around the world, often coinciding with a major trade deal. It's been dubbed panda diplomacy. But now these very popular ambassadors are being recalled.
I think that this has been a knee-jerk reaction to a very ugly period in U.S.-China relations.
Dennis Wilder is a professor at Georgetown University and a former White House China official. He says the Chinese were angered by Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan last year. Then things soured even more after the U.S. shot down the alleged Chinese spy balloon early this year. It's not surprising, he says, that China would withhold pandas in response.
It's very typically Chinese. This is kind of Chinese diplomacy. We've seen it in the commercial sector.
For example, he says, during a spat with Australia over COVID, China imposed 200% tariffs on Australian wine. With the pandas, it's not just D.C. Zoos in Memphis and San Diego also had to send their animals back after leases expired and were not renewed. The last giant pandas in the U.S. are in Atlanta, and they're scheduled to head home early next year.
Panda diplomacy has been positive, but panda diplomacy can become punitive panda diplomacy as well.
In D.C., at least, panda diplomacy appears to have been wildly successful, so much so that this bear, the official national animal of China, has also become a sort of symbol of the U.S. capital city. For example, Metro's old fare cards featured a panda design for years. Elena Songster is a history professor at St. Mary's College of California. She wrote the book Panda Nation. She says panda diplomacy has worked to soften people's attitudes toward China. But she says it's worked almost too well in places like D.C., where the lovable bears have become entwined with local identity.
I think in some ways, people identify the panda as theirs, as much as or more than they think of it as something from China.
Songster says there does seem to be a big shift taking place with the panda loan program, since China's taking back all the U.S. pandas at the same time. But she doesn't think there's enough evidence yet to say it's happening because China is mad at the United States.
I'm actually very interested in just watching this unfold a little bit, because I do think that this is a significant moment.
The National Zoo has hosted two pairs of pandas. The first ones died of old age in the 1990s. While much of panda diplomacy has been about the symbolism, the friendship between the two countries, there's also been real scientific exchange over the decades. Smithsonian scientists from D.C. have collaborated with Chinese researchers on more than 100 books and scientific papers. Andrew Murtha says this aspect of the panda loan program is often underappreciated. He's director of the China Studies Program at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, or SAIS.
In this day and age, when collaboration with China over science and research is very much a political lightning rod, this points to both perhaps a simpler time, but also those areas in which these types of exchanges can continue, even with the political climate in which we find ourselves.
The three pandas, Meishang, Tiantian, and their cub Xiao Qiji, are traveling on a FedEx Boeing 777 freight plane, along with more than 200 pounds of bamboo. That's one day's meal for the bears. Panda keeper Marielle Lally spent the past few weeks crate training the bears, just like you would with a pet. They've gotten used to hanging out in the big metal boxes.
Especially Meisheng, she would just sit in the crate all day if we let her. She doesn't even need a reward when she goes in there at this point. She just wants to sit in there.
Lally is traveling with the pandas on the 19-hour flight from Dulles to Chengdu. She says it's bittersweet to say goodbye to the animals.
I grew up coming to the zoo and seeing Meisheng and Tiantian as a kid. So definitely from, like, childhood to working with them now 7.5 years, it is hard to see them go.
But she says she's proud of the work the zoo has done with the pandas and proud of the bears themselves. National Zoo officials say they haven't yet begun talks to get more pandas from China, but they say they're optimistic. In fact, while the panda house is empty, the zoo plans to revamp the enclosures and outdoor habitat. Mike Beglinger is the zoo's associate director of facilities and exhibits.
We're going to redo the faux rock. We're going to do new pools. And we're going to put in a climbing structure assembly for, you know, different elevations for the pandas when they come back. So it's going to be great.
It's basically a $2.5 million bet that pandas will be returning. Dennis Wilder, the Georgetown professor, is also in a betting mood.
I would put a bit of betting money, not maybe a huge amount of betting money, on perhaps the situation changing after President Xi and President Biden meet at the APEC summit in San Francisco.
That meeting is scheduled for later this month. Both countries are hoping it leads to better relations. Wilder says it's entirely possible Beijing could send another pair of pandas to Washington to signal things are on the mend.
I have talked to Chinese diplomats who say, look, the pandas have been more effective diplomats for China than we have been. So I think they know the value of this.
For The World, I'm Jacob Fenston in Washington.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here again tomorrow. Marco here. Before we go, just a reminder that right now The World is holding our fall fundraising drive. Your support is critical. It powers our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting. Our goal is to raise $67,000 before the end of the year. Every gift counts. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much and be well.